You're listening to TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio. Now, TalkZone presents the Cyber Advisor. This is the show that looks at the people and events that move the financial markets and shape our economy. Here's your host for the Cyber Advisor, David Revelle.
Markets will fluctuate. It's the most famous quote on all of investing ever. And legend has it that it was J.P. Morgan's answer to where he thought the markets would go in the future. It's both obvious and especially timely right now. Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the January 8th edition of the Cyber Advisor. I'm your host, Dave Revelle, and this show is being pre-recorded so that we aren't taking any phone calls today. But remember, you can reach me anytime on my email. It's dave@thecyberadvisor.com. Well, on this first show of the new year, we thought we'd take a look back at 2009 and see just what it tells us about our investing for the year ahead, 2010. It was one of those years where everybody was right and everybody was wrong. The year began with that dramatic slide, which had begun way back in September and October of 2008, and saw day after day of unrelenting decline in the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finally landed down at 6,600, which erased over 50% of its total value. Standard & Poor's 500 did just about the same, landing down at an ominous 666 on that index. Do you remember that sickening feeling you got as you felt that, gee, this slide might not end? Well, we thought we would look back and take a look at the five best and five worst days of the year with the help of the Wall Street Journal. And the year started out, as we said, in very bad shape. The first really bad day of the new year was on January 20th. It was the day Barack Obama was inaugurated as President of the United States, and it was the worst stock market response to a new president being sworn in the 113 years of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. On that day, the Standard & Poor's 500 was down 5.3%. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 4%. News was that the asset manager State Street Bank, one of the largest custodians in the world, was sitting on tremendous unrealized losses in its investment portfolio, and that sent a bad mood all around the world, including the United Kingdom's government announcement of an expansion of its financial rescue plan amid concern that there would be continued losses at all of the British banks. Quote, "There is so much pressure from financials," said Warren Myers, who's managing partner of W.J. Dodd, that he told the Journal, "There's just too much negative financial news around." Well, the very next day, the market rebounded sharply, and on January 21st, the Dow rose 3.5%, and the Standard & Poor's 500 jumped 4.4%. That was double-digit percentage gains for Citicorp, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan, as the major banks were sent dramatically higher. The Standard & Poor's 500 saw a 14% gain in the financial stocks, which were component of the S&P, and they had been hit low in the previous session. Banks got a late-day boost from the report that several Bank of America directors, including Chief Executive Officer Ken Lewis, who has since, as you know, left the bank, they personally bought more than 500,000 shares the previous day in Bank of America. It was an apparent show of confidence in that lender. So January 20th, a very big down day, rebounding up on the 21st, up about 3.5% on the Dow. The next day, the next big day in the market came on February 10th, about 2 weeks later, when the Standard & Poor's 500 slid almost 5%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up or rather down, I'm sorry, about 4.5%. Markets did not like at all Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's anticipated speech on getting credit flowing back into the economy. There was a lack, said the market, of either detail or really a good plan ahead. This is the shock and ugh plan, said Ethan Harris. Now, he's the chief U.S. economist at Barclays Capital at the time. The next really big day in the market was also a down day a week later on February 17th when the Standard & Poor's 500 once again down over 4.5%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down about 3.8%, and the gloom continued on Wall Street. There was worries about the global economy and the health of financial institutions, and it drove investors out of stocks and into gold and treasury bonds. The theme of gold was to continue all year long, whether markets were up or down. Gold continued to soar. We've been told, we've told clients that there will eventually be great buying opportunities in this market, but it's not the time to be a hero, said Keith Wirtz. He's the president and chief investment officer of Fifth Third Asset Management, a division of Fifth Third Bank. Next big day on the market was a rebound. It was an up day exactly 1 week later on February 24th. The Dow suddenly up 3.3%. The Standard & Poor's closed up 4% on that day as the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told the Senate committee that nationalization of major U.S. banks was not going to be needed. That was great and refreshing news for the markets. Citigroup and Bank of America jumped more than 20% on that single day, February 24th, earlier in 2009. Well, the next big day flips back again on the downside just a couple of days later, about 6 days later on March 2nd. The Standard & Poor's 500 once again on the downside, down 4.7%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average also down over 4%. And it was worries that the economic recovery might still be a long way off that pushed them both to 12-year lows at that time. Doreen Magavoto, the president of the New York floor brokerage firm, Lee and Company, said the market will only stop falling when people run out of stocks to sell. It was very, very gloomy, and as we know now, pretty close to the end of all the bad news. Well, in fact, 1 week later on March 10th, we had a huge rally in the market as the Dow gained over 5%, almost 6%. Standard & Poor's 500 was up just about 6.5%. And stocks posted their first major rally of 2009. It gave traders and investors some respite after months of a slow, dripping decline. The one-day surge came as worries about the solvency of the nation's largest banks were eased for the day after Citigroup's chief executive officer Vikram Pandit told employees in a memo the night before that the company was profitable for the first time in January and February. Well, the final big day really of the market happened then on April 20th when after that rally continued for about 3 weeks. Finally, there was a reaction to the rally. The Standard & Poor's 500 slipped down about 4 points that day. Dow Jones down about 3.5 points. Stocks tumbled to their most since early March after they had notched a 6 week rally that marked the market's biggest percentage gain over such a period since way back in the 1930s. That market, you may recall, was a reaction to the 29 crash. Here, a reaction to what had been a long going crash, if you will, in the markets. Market veterans wondered whether the rally was going to run out of fuel. Bank of America on that single day fell 24% to $8.02 after reporting its first quarter profit rose, but not as much as was anticipated. Investors focused instead on the pessimistic outlook for Bank of America write-offs. Well, how to put all of this market in perspective. As you know, it's been a very good market since then, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average on the year. It was up 1,651 points. That's 18.8%. And it's the best yearly gain for all of the indexes since way back in 2003. NASDAQ was up 692 points. That's 43%, if you can believe it. And the best since 2003, when incidentally saw the NASDAQ rise 50% in a single year. Standard & Poor's 500 up 200 points, 23%, biggest percentage gain again since 2003. One of the most interesting interviews that we got to listen into this year was from Neil Ferguson. Professor Ferguson is a professor of economic history at both Harvard University, the Harvard Business School, and also the London School of Economics. He received his PhD from the London School of Economics. And in this interview, which was recorded earlier in the year by CNN, we had a chance to listen into just exactly what he thought was driving the markets. And the interviewer had asked him, is there anything unique about this recession? And here is Neil Ferguson's answer.
I think this isn't a recession, is the first point to make. It's a near depression. In fact, I'm calling it the slight depression to distinguish it from the Great Depression of 1929 to 33. And the unique thing is that we nearly repeated history. In other words, we nearly repeated the Great Depression, but we avoided it with massive monetary and fiscal stimulus. So we are in new territory.
We might add, as you listen to that, you might see his calling it a near depression. And one of the key indicators of the fact that it is a near depression has been the labor markets, where currently we see unemployment, the headline figure, at currently 10%, down from 10.2%, anticipation that it may rise another tick. But U6 is probably the best measure of unemployment, certainly the closest unemployment figure we have to the way they measured unemployment back in the 30s. U6 currently at about 16%. The equivalent unemployment rate in the Depression was 25%. So when Neil Ferguson talks about this being a near depression and so on, certainly the unemployment figures bear that out. It's been one of the worst markets, worst employment markets we've seen certainly since the 30s. Next, Professor Ferguson was asked, when does government intervention work and when does it not work? And here is his answer.
We're talking very specifically here about two policies. One is the use of central bank money-creating power to avoid a liquidity crisis that crunches the entire banking system. But the other kind of government intervention, which is slightly more problematic, is the sort in which the government runs a large deficit in order to stimulate the economy by building roads and building bridges in order to get people back to work, in the hope that in doing that it'll generate a recovery. And to some extent this has been effective, but the problem is that in the United States, you're adding a stimulus on top of an already huge structural deficit in the public finances. And the prospect of $1 trillion of new borrowing every year for the decade ahead, that scares me, and I think it should scare everybody.
Now, when Professor Ferguson is talking about the role of the Fed and the shoring up of the financial markets, he's really talking about the role of TARP in this whole financial program. Then when he talks later about the stimulus, that's the stimulus program, the $750 billion program that was put in by the Obama administration. This is a critical distinction, and Ferguson is the first one to make this distinction early last year. And in evaluating those two programs, you really have to look at them in a second, as apart from each other. TARP has demonstrated that up to date now it has been very successful. Stimulus has not been successful. We have not seen the decline in employment that has been expected, and we haven't yet seen the turnaround in the economy. TARP versus stimulus, key distinction. The next, Professor Ferguson was asked, what advice does he have to policymakers who are trying to reform the financial system? And here's his response.
Nobody dares risk another Lehman Brothers. So if any of the big five or six institutions gets into trouble, it's kind of automatic that they'll be bailed out. Now, that's not a state of affairs we can really live with. It's not healthy that there should be only upside for the bankers and only downside for the taxpayers. So I think we need to phase out that guarantee to bondholders and make it very clear that if an institution is as large as a Citigroup or a Bank of America, it can't count on a government bailout.
And again, Ferguson, you hear in this response, is one of the first people to deal with this too-big-to-fail issue, this tactic of government which gives a kind of a tacit guarantee that the bondholders at least will be made whole. Now, back when he made this comment, the chief concerns out there were with the large commercial banks such as Citicorp and Bank of America. But we now know that the problem is much bigger than that. Although the banks seem to have been recovering and doing quite nicely, thank you, the problem seems to be more focused now on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And going forward, those two organizations with their tacit government assurance are going to be really the focus, we think, of the financial markets in 2010. And finally, Ferguson makes, I think, the most dead-on comment as to what the real cause of this financial problem has been, and here he says it in real simple terms, Professor Ferguson.
The real problem here was excessive leverage. Institutions that had assets equivalent to 25 or 30 times their tangible equity were not stable institutions, because really quite a small decline in the value of their assets wiped out the equity. So we need to be more Canadian. The Canadians were among the very few people whose banks were more strictly regulated, and that was single one respect, that they were not allowed to become excessively leveraged. And that's actually a really sensible approach.
So as you can see, excess leverage. Excess leverage has always been the key and the key problem. When he says that his bank, Royal Bank, or when he says that the Canadian model is better, Canadian leverage really rarely exceeds 10, possibly 12 times capital on all of their commercial and mortgage banks, whereas here in the States, it was not unusual to see at least 30 times capital leverage, and sometimes even greater than that. As we understand the European model, you are sometimes seeing leverage factors of 50%. It takes a very small decline in earnings power for you not to be able to meet your leverage obligations, your borrowing, to be able to service your borrowing. Well, that's our recap, not just for the week, but for the year. It's time for a short break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more right after this.